how it works, you can basically imagine it like a ginormous metal detector. You know, people walking along the beaches with those little rings on a stick, in a sense, that make beep, 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 yeah. beep, when they get closer to something conductive. That's basically what we do, but just with a ginormous ring.
Okay.
That has a much, much stronger and much more complex signal. And we're not just listening for the beep, 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 but we're basically playing a symphony, and we're trying to understand the instruments that we hear in the measurements, because they, again, then tell you something about the electrical properties of the ground. And those electric properties of the ground, they in turn give you indication on whether you are, you know, flying over hard rock or over soft sediments or over fractured rock or the different types of geologies.
Hear more about the growing use of airborne geophysical investigation techniques after this advert.
Central Piling are proud to sponsor the Breaking Ground podcast. It aligns with our goals of providing technical expertise, continuous improvement, and community engagement. These are things we've been striving for since our inception over 40 years ago. Some of the engineering achievements during that time include the design and construction of the foundations for West London's tallest residential building, complex 3D finite element analysis to facilitate the creation of a triple-storey basement, and damage impact assessments for underground assets on a rotary-cased piling contract. Our plant includes a wide range of bored piling machine sizes. These are continually being updated to ensure emission regulation compliance and efficiency. We're also able to offer driven precast and steel piling on selected contracts. To learn more about what we do and discover details of how we might be able to help you on your next foundation or retaining wall scheme, visit centralpiling.com.
Hello, thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Breaking Ground podcast. Today I'm joined by Andy Pfaffhuber and Chris Presdy from Emerald Geomodeling. Andy's the CEO and founder of Emerald, and Chris is a principal engineering geologist based here in the UK. Andy, you're from Norway, and I know that this company has taken several years to come about, but you've been doing a lot of research. You're actually a doctor in geophysics, is that right?
That's correct, Steve. Yeah, I'm actually not exactly from Norway. I am in Norway, but I am originally from Austria. Excellent. I was born and grew up in Austria, and then I spent quite some time in Germany, and now I've been in Norway for about 15 years or so.
Okay, well, I picked up from your CV that you'd worked with a group called the Norwegian Geotechnical Institute, which I assume is a government body, and presumably it was there that you came to develop your skills and the technology that we're going to talk about in this episode. Is that correct? Have I got that bit right?
Well, you know, that is pretty correct. Absolutely, Steve. It's been quite a journey for me. As I said, I originally took a PhD in geophysics, and I was really deep in the academic side of things. I was in polar research at that time. But for the most part of my professional career, which has been about 12 years at NGI, the Norwegian Geotechnical Institute, I was really in that exciting world of doing applied research, doing consulting work, being on that kind of interface between developing stuff and really solving real-world solutions. So that's why I learned everything about geotechnical engineering and where I saw opportunities for technology which can be used in innovative ways. And that brought me in the end towards, you know, testing and discovering some of the methods that we did at that private research institute, and one of them that in the end led to the establishment of Emerald Geomodeling as a spin-off.
So, Andy, what then prompted the move into a commercial environment?
So, you know, NGI, it is a private foundation. So it's not a governmental institution. It is private, but it has its main aim is to improve methods and to serve society and do some consulting on the side, you know, relevant work. And this was a very great place to be, and it was a great place to to develop my team that I had there and apply new methods. But over the time, when we saw that what we built there within this research institute, we saw that there was a much, much bigger potential for that technology out in so to say, in the real world than just as one of many, many activities in one big institute. So that is really what drove then the strategic decision within NGI to scale this up, to spin it out into its independent company, into a truly commercial company, and really bring that value to the world that we saw and had proven in Norway and some international projects, but really, pretty much really getting the potential out there and scaling it for the benefit of infrastructure projects worldwide.
Okay, well, it's great that they would support you on such an enterprise. I've got a podcast coming up in a few weeks where we're going to look at all different aspects of geophysics, but let's talk about the applications that your business offers and some of the projects. I've done a little bit of research. There seems to be a plethora of different techniques, microgravity, magnetometry. I know that the technology that you use involves helicopters. I know that you can create huge models across large land masses, and as you mentioned there, particularly applicable to infrastructure projects. But would you mind just explaining to the listeners exactly how your application works and some of the science behind it?
Absolutely. And as you said, geophysics as such is a very, very wide field, and it includes all sorts of technologies and all sorts of applications. And the vast majority of geophysicists is still working in exploration, right? Looking for hydrocarbons, looking for minerals. That's where geophysics has always been used to a large extent. And then there are different niches of smaller activities. And the use of geophysical methods for infrastructure, for the planning and construction work has been something that's been going on for a long time, but it's on a much smaller scale with much smaller budgets, and has had its individual challenges. You have a completely different value proposition if you need to take the decision to make an enormous investment to put an offshore drilling rig somewhere to drill a hole to look for oil or gas. You are very willing to invest a lot of money in geophysical investigations before that, so that you really drill at the best spot. Now, when you think about geotechnical drillings, they cost a little bit less than an offshore drilling platform.
Yes.
And you have you're in a different place when it comes to the toolbox that is a typical geotechnical project involves. That is very much driven by a lot of boreholes, by a lot of manual work, groundwork, accessing ground, accessing properties. But at the same time, then you know that you always have just very limited information, and you would always want to have more information. It is known and accepted that the more information you have up front, the more you will save later. But
you could get this information presumably in a standard conventional approach with thousands of boreholes. But really what we're looking at here is being able to cover a vast amount of ground very quickly and supplementing the use of the technology, the geophysics technology, with a smaller amount of boreholes than you might use in a conventional approach. But let's drill down, forgive the pun, on the technology itself. So you've got a helicopter flying over the land. That's supporting a device. It's trying to pick up moisture. How's it work?
No, it's really much. It's really about what you said. It's acquiring information very efficiently over big areas, and the exact geophysical method that we use for this comes out of mineral exploration and comes out of groundwater exploration, and it's called airborne electromagnetics. This is a quite big operation. If it flies by you, it's a quite big instrument that is suspended about 30, 50 meters under a helicopter and then flies about 30 meters above the ground with that system. And how it works, you can basically imagine it like a ginormous metal detector. You know, people walking along the beaches with those little rings on a stick, in a sense, that make beep, 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 yeah. beep, when they get closer to something conductive. That's basically what we do, but just with a ginormous ring
okay.
that has a much, much stronger and much more complex signal. And we're not just listening for the beep, 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 but we're basically playing a symphony, and we're trying to understand the instruments that we hear in the measurements, because they, again, then tell you something about the electrical properties of the ground. And those electric properties of the ground, they in turn give you indication on whether you are, you know, flying over hard rock or over soft sediments or over fractured rock or the different types of geology. So that is the number one key element of
what. So let me get this right. So the ring is effectively electromagnet, so it sends a signal, and the time it takes to come back gives you an indication of the resistivity, I don't know if that's the right term, of the ground, which in turn indicates whether it's a soft soil or a rock, and that's the crucial bit of information. So it knows the depth to the ground surface. It knows the depth of different soft soils and different rocks, and then that can be used within design. Is that it in a nutshell?
Pretty much. It's a little bit more than that, because it's that electromagnetic signal. It's not like you kind of shoot it into the ground and then it comes back and you just see how long it took. It is an electromagnetic signal that you switch off, and then you kind of listen, in a sense, how that signal is diffusing into the ground over time. And in that way, you don't just have a reflection of some sort of horizon, but you actually get information about the properties of the ground from the first meters down to hundreds of meters of depth. And those properties, exactly as you say, we can then relate to what kind of ground material you're talking about. And there is the really crucial bit about how we treat these data and how we have seen that you can get really the best value out of them. And that is that we use various sets of machine learning algorithms to combine these geophysical measurements that, to begin with, doesn't really tell you anything. They're just electrical properties. That's not what an engineer is interested in, or most are not. so we combine these measurements with some ground investigations that might already exist, or a very small number of ground investigations that are planned based on the helicopter scanning that is being done to begin with, and then train various machine learning algorithms to create the 3D models of the actual properties that are of relevance, right? So if it is about to investigate how much sediments are on top of rock, and you need to know where that rock interface is, then that is the question, in a sense, that we ask the machine learning to give us an answer for.
Yeah, so you're correlating a borehole that's just under where the helicopter has been, and then you're asking the machine to interpolate between various different positions using the information that the helicopter's gathered from that whole space. And then you've got this, well, I've seen some of the imagery, and we'll post it on the show notes and put links in for everybody. But you get these fantastic three-dimensional models of the ground, and presumably using some software, actually you can slice it up and say, right, at this point, this is what the ground looks like. So I think at this point it would be useful to talk about its application. And Chris, let's give Andy a little bit of a break for a minute from the science and talk about some of the places that it's been used around the world and the way in which it's been used. Clearly, we've discussed it being used in Norway, so it seems like a good place to start. How can your clients use this technology to save the money?
Well, first of all, Steve, I must say I'm very impressed with your homework. You sound like you've done a lot of reading and you come across as someone with a lot of knowledge of this.
Thank you.
It's putting me to shame, actually, because I'm not a geophysicist. I'm a geologist. So I don't even claim to pretend to understand the details of geophysics. But what I do know is from 20 years of working in ground investigation that uncertainty in geological models for the design or planning the alignment of a road or a tunnel or whatever it is one of the biggest challenges on those projects. We've talked about boreholes and we've talked about integrating the helicopter geophysics. And the key outcome, as you said, is the 3D model, which uses machine learning to interpolate between discrete borehole locations. Previously, and while still currently, a lot of projects are reliant upon experience to interpret what's in between the boreholes. And that experience can be from an individual or from another project, but it's still, at best, a guess. So the value of a quantified integration process, which is effectively what we do, is to reduce that uncertainty. Now, it's really tricky, I found, to quantify the tangible benefits that clients have already experienced and hopefully will do in the future from our solutions. But to put it very simply, reducing the uncertainty on a construction project, whether it's a residential or an infrastructure project, improves the outcomes of your project. And those outcomes can be measured by time, by quality, and by cost. So those are the three parameters that project managers are trained in, the basics, the most important things that classify the success or not of a project. So by reducing uncertainty, we know that we can reduce the risk of a schedule overrun because you're better informed. You can plan for conditions in the ground in advance. So to put that in even more simple terms, the excavatability of the ground is better planned with the right equipment without any surprises. So that's a good thing. Clients obviously love that. The cost as a result of reducing your program is quite a nice direct correlation, probably, but there are bigger benefits to be had. Mm-hmm. It's not just reducing the construction program, it is accelerating the completion of the project, which for most project owners brings about a return on the investment. The investment is the design and construction. The return comes from the use or operation of that asset. So if we can bring that earlier, get the asset operational earlier, then there's indirect, huge commercial benefits to the owner of that asset. So it's all about providing insights, providing information on the ground so that our clients can plan better, construct, I would say, on time, definitely with less overrun. We can't promise to make sure that a project construction is faster than it was planned, but we can certainly minimize the risk of delays. And the other big benefit is the reduction in cost uncertainty. and generation of income earlier.
Sure. So, and one of those projects, because I think it always enlightens the conversation when we talk about real schemes, it was the E6 highway project in Norway, and there was going to be a lot of tunneling on that scheme, and in the build up to this call, you were explaining some of the changes in the decisions of the planning for that project. Can you just enlighten the listeners a little bit about how you work with the client to change their methodology? Sure. And how that helped them?
Sure. So this road had sections which were designed to be in tunnels, and at that stage of the project, the project owner, based on the information that they had, understood that some of these tunnels would be in competent bedrock materials. Now, we did a airborne electromagnetic survey and found that one of these tunnels was not in competent, nice, strong bedrock, but in very soft clays. And I think the key thing to say here is that we found that within weeks. Okay, so this led the client to assess the alignment of that tunnel, the lateral and vertical alignment of that particular asset. They chose to relocate this tunnel structure a few hundred meters laterally away from its original position and deeper than it was originally intended, because they had the knowledge and the data to make that decision based upon the survey that we did. So we provided them with a model that showed them where the rock was, where the clay was, and they changed the alignment of that proposed tunnel to enable the design and construction to be much lower risk.
One of the things that I found quite amusing was that actually, in the UK, we'd probably tend to go towards drilling through softer material for tunneling because it's a lot cheaper. But actually, in Norway, it was the opposite. They knew what they were dealing with the rock, and so they were looking for the rock because they wanted to choose that route because it made the construction, I don't know if the construction was easier, just that it was more reliable. Andy, maybe you want to come in at that point to explain some of the civil engineering methods in Norway.
In that particular setting, the construction of the tunnel in hard rock was not just easier, but way, way, way cheaper than a very shallow tunnel in the soft sediments that would have been the alternative. This would have involved a huge, probably cut and cover operation where you have to excavate a big, big, big area in very, very unstable, sensitive clay. So this would have been an enormous cost overrun if they would have had to end up to really build there where it was originally planned. So it's, you know, hard rock drill and blast tunneling is very, very established in Norway and has been done for decades, and is one of the key methods to deal with natural hazards in, you know, all the along the west coast where you have very steep topography and you have the fjords and you have the mountains, and there is basically no space to be reasonably safe for a road or a railway, and the only the easiest solution is actually just to build a tunnel. And
I was just going to say I'm fascinated by the geology of Norway. Unfortunately, not had the opportunity to go there yet, but it's certainly on my list of places to visit, hopefully this year. And I think lots of us would have seen the footage. I think it was last year, possibly the year before, of the houses that essentially floated down a slope in Norway, and that was because of some of the extremely soft soils that you get there, lying at the foot of the fjords. just tell us a little bit about the mechanism by which they start to liquefaction is the verb, isn't it? But what changes within the soil to make that happen?
Well, in fact, that's really, really dramatic, and one of the most dramatic quick clay slides that we've had in Norway. It happened where not that far where I used to live, so it was not a nice experience to follow all that. Obviously, not for anybody. And quick clay is a very special and a very nasty material, and it is common in generally in the higher latitudes. So it's not just a problem in Norway. It's you've got the same type of materials in Canada, Finland, Sweden, and it is a remnant from the ice ages. These are formerly marine sediments, marine clays that were deposited at the end of the ice age. Now, or since after the ice age, were exposed to, became terrestrial sediments with the isostatic lift. These marine sediments turned into superficial sediments and have since the ice age just been exposed to groundwater and rainwater. And the original salinity, the original seawater that was in the pores of the clay has been slowly leached, and the salinity has been decreased. And that is what turns these marine sediments into what we call quick clay, which means that when they fail, as you indicated, they become basically a liquid and float away. And that's why you have these really dramatic failures when they happen. And they're very widespread over the lowlands of Norway. I mean, most of Oslo and the Oslo area is surrounded with it. Also around Trondheim, so really where you actually have the biggest number of people living, you have quick clay. And it's also most of the farmland, because right, I mean that is the land that is not the steep mountains that everybody knows and has seen and are really beautiful. It is the lowlands. It's the farmable land that is very, very often then this material that potentially contains quick clay. And as I explained the whole thing about the development of this material, that it has something to do with the salt content, this is actually also one of the parameters that we can derive from our geophysical measurements, as we are looking at the electrical resistivity, which is primarily driven by, or in parts driven by, the pore water, by the salinity. We actually can pick up the tiny differences between the original saline marine clay and the leached and potentially sensitive quick clays. So this is one of the most challenging applications, because the differences are very, very small, and consequently, again, a use case where the machine learning and the combination of actually not just the geophysics and the boreholes, but also actual samples. So we really start this whole workflow then with lab tests that are being done on samples, scale them up to geotechnical investigations in an area, and then scale them further up to the whole 3D model from the airborne measurements. So this is hopefully making a little bit of a contribution to mitigate this risk.
Yeah, it must be extremely concerning for the people of Norway. You mentioned there in major urban areas, it's on this ground. Climate change and the melting of the permafrost is only going to exacerbate these issues. Presumably, governments in Canada and Scandinavia are looking into your sort of technology to assess the risks involved and potentially put in some sort of remedial solution. I don't know what remedial solutions would be available. It might actually be a case of migrating people away from high-risk areas.
If I can jump in there, Steve. This is the super advanced stuff, which I think it's worth dwelling on. So quick clays you can't, they're generally covered by a layer of topsoil, right? So you know, you can't assess a locality and determine there whether it's quick clays or not. And even within a body of potential quick clays, there will be some horizons which have still got a structure and a strength governed by the bonds between positive and negative ions. And there'll be layers within it which have not got that strength and can be liquefied. And I think when you talk about climate change, it is interesting to realize that some of these failures of the quick clay deposits can be attributed to intense heavy rainfall events, because these are events which can add significant mass to the soil, and if that has a geometry that can be affected by an increase in loading, then that could potentially cause that quick clay to fail. So it is becoming a risk as these cities grow and develop. You know, this failure we talked about a few years ago, it wasn't that far from Oslo, I believe. And so, you know, humans are spreading out into these areas, and these quick clay soils have proven to be a significant challenge and a hazard. And I think will continue to be so, and even more so as rainfall intensifies and slopes become more challenging hazards. And I think that would be nice to quickly talk about the project, which I think was over 10 years ago now, that Andy worked on to look at the use of airborne electromagnetics to try and identify potential slope failures in a project in Norway.
Yeah, let's hear all about it. Tell me, Andy.
Now, this was in fact the very first time that we tested this method in Norway for a geotechnical kind of application. This is on the west coast in the very, very nice area, very touristic area, a location called Flum, where a lot of cruise ships go in. You know, kind of the postcard Norway that you imagine. And up on one of those beautiful mountain slopes, there is actually a huge part of the rock mass that is slowly moving towards the fjord. And this is not the only one. There are plenty of them in Norway, and some of them are really actively monitored at all times. I think there are two locations I'm aware of where there is an active warning and monitoring system in place and really evacuation routines for the people that live there. Because if such a big rock slide happens, this triggers an enormous tsunami and has devastating effects. And this has happened in the past in the I don't actually remember when, but it's you're not talking about many, many decades ago. Luckily that last time something like this happened. But this was the kind of the case, and this is where we for the first time assessed whether we could use this helicopter method to get up there, right? Doing any sort of ground investigations up at 1,300 meters above sea level, when you actually stand at sea level and look up to that slope, it's really difficult. And the taking a helicopter and flying back and forth and gaining some knowledge about the ground seemed very promising. And that's where my research background came in handy back in the days, because my PhD was in that airborne method, but using it for something completely different. Yes, and that's what we tested there, and it brought really good success. We could see where the base of that big rock mass was, where it was sliding, where a lot of fine materials and not a lot of water had accumulated. And it gave more knowledge, it gave more data to start to develop also a monitoring system for that particular area, and we extended it then also further down the valley to investigate also unstable rock masses there that were a hazard for the railway and for the roads that is down there. So it's what I personally certainly have learned in all my years in Norway, it's fantastic landscape, and it is very complex with natural hazards everywhere. In the lower lands you have the quick clay, and where it's more steep you have the rock slides, and you have the avalanches in winter, and you have the really, really complex system, and these issues certainly are changing with climate change. They have increased. It's been a bigger and bigger topic, and most of it, of course, influenced by rainfall, floods, but also more frequent landslides and rock slides triggered by strong rain events.
Yeah, well, I mean, in these sort of topographies, unless you're Van Alphines or a Sherpa, you're not going to be able to access it with conventional equipment. So the only way really to get around is using the helicopter technology that you're talking about. And I know that you've even been out to the Himalayas and looked at a project there with the Indian, was it direct with the Indian Railway?
Road.
Yeah. Oh, it was a road project. Can you tell us a little bit about the work there and the solution that was developed?
So, I mean, yeah, we worked for the National Highways and Infrastructure Development Corporation, and they wanted to look at building some major roads in the Kashmir province of India. And as you can imagine, hopefully everyone listening can imagine, the Himalayas, very steep, very high mountains, very challenging to, as you say, get equipment and people to where they need to be to undertake the investigations. So we successfully acquired data from our helicopter electromagnetic surveys. And, you know, this was not a routine survey. This was up at 5,000-ish meters above sea level. So it was, I think it was a first for us, potentially a first anywhere in the world, to test the equipment at such a high elevation. And we had to bring in special helicopters because of the altitude. We had a number of very specific things that we had to do to make sure that obviously the project was safe. You get turbulence, you get very strange winds occurring in the mountains. And all of this came, I think, just at the time when COVID hit Europe as well. So we had an extra layer of complexity to try and manage this project during a pandemic, which was causing, obviously, travel and logistical difficulties all around the world. We did the survey for about 6 weeks, I think, in total. And we managed to generate some really, really nice geological models, which, when they were integrated with the sort of sparse boreholes that could be drilled, you know, we really, I think, helped the de-risking of those roads and those tunnels in such a harsh and challenging environment, because we could identify weakness zones. And as I said earlier, the knowledge that you have, you know, you can then design your way, you can design a solution to accommodate those challenges. If you don't know what you're going into, if you're building a tunnel, then these changes in rock strength or water ingress can slow down, it can stop your construction, and it can be quite a significant health and safety challenge for those people working in that environment as well. So I think,
talking about health and safety challenges, the idea of flying a helicopter above the Himalayas terrifies me. I don't know if you, Chris, or Andy go in the helicopter yourself, but I can imagine there's a lot of logistical challenges in arranging something like that, because, as we said, you're based in Europe, but you're now working in India, you're working in Brazil. How does it all work? How do you get the stuff about? If I was a client and I'm in the Philippines and I want you to get involved in a project, what are we looking at time wise from inception to analysis?
it's a great question. But we work with a small number of very specialist partners who have the ability and experience to go anywhere in the world. So by that, I mean the equipment that we use and the helicopters that we use. We have partnerships with specialist companies who can mobilize anywhere in the world. Probably the biggest challenge that we find is permitting. It's not a routine day-to-day operation. Flying a helicopter, carrying a load, people are going to be concerned and people are going to be surprised. So there's a big piece to talk about communication here. It's all about making sure all of the stakeholders are aware and informed of what is going to happen and the public. Because if you can imagine, you mentioned the Philippines, well, I would say actually anywhere in the world, if you saw a helicopter carrying this large ring underneath it at relatively low elevations, you would be quite rightly be shocked and surprised and think, what the hell is going on? So luckily, we work with experts and we can come to work anywhere in the world. The question you asked was about timeframes. Once we have all of the logistical permits and paperwork in place, which in some countries can take only a matter of weeks, in others it can take a few months, that's probably the most critical path on our program. The acquisition of the helicopter data generally can be done in a matter of days, depending on how big the survey area is. And the analysis or processing and interpretation of that data through to generation of a digital model is weeks. And by weeks, I mean 4 to 6 weeks after the helicopter is in the air.
Yeah. And it, as you were talking about earlier, in terms of delivery of these schemes, one of the key things that we're looking for is speeding up these investigations. And let's face it, major infrastructure schemes can and do improve the lives of billions of people around the world. So it'll be interesting and rewarding, I think, to see the development of this sort of technology across the globe in the next decades. So Chris, Andy, thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to write down the last hour of CPD, and I'm sure you'll make yourself available if our listeners have got questions on via probably LinkedIn is the easiest way to get in touch. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Much appreciated.
Thanks for listening. A few dates for your diary from our friends at Ground Engineering Magazine. Transport Geotechnics Conference is on the 19th of May this year. Got the Piling and Foundations Conference on the 29th of June. And the favourite, the GE Awards on Tuesday, the 6th of September. Hope to see you at more of those. Bye-bye.